This is an ABC podcast.
We have produced this podcast on Awabakal land, and we've spoken to people living and working on Aboriginal land across Australia. We pay our respects to the elders, past and present, who continue to be among Australia's greatest storytellers and educators, passing on their knowledge using oral traditions and practices. Hi, I'm Kurt Fernley, Paralympian and proud person with a disability.
And I'm Sarah Shands, mum of a budding engineer with a disability.
I built a place for my squishy mellow jellyfish made out of blocks with little plastic diamonds in them so it's pretty.
I need one of those.
We all do.
This is Let Us In, a podcast series all about what it's like to be a person with a disability living in Australia today. We've put this series together because it's time you knew a few things about what life can be like for people with a disability. And a good place to start is back in 1985. No, not that 1985. I'm talking regional Australia 1985. Which is kind of like 1955. I'm 4 years old. It's November, and we're in a little town in western New South Wales called Carcor. My brothers and sisters, they're at school, and it might be a warm and sunny day, but I'm inside playing with my Matchbox cars while Mum's doing the washing. There's a knock at the door, and there's two people that I have never seen in my life, both just standing there. Mum invites them into the kitchen and then ushers me out into another room. I knew they were there because of me, but I didn't know why. I'm in another room desperately trying to listen to what they're saying and I'm only catching bits and pieces. It's such a strange feeling when someone is talking about you and you kind of know what they're saying, but you also don't. It just seems foreign. These people were from the Department of Education and they were telling my mum that there were places for people like me. A special school for special kids. That sending me to my local school would be too hard. How would I even get into the classroom, they'd ask. Mum was shaken when they left, but she pulled me in for a cuddle and then she went back to the washing and I went back to playing. Then there was another knock at the door. This time it was the principal from Carcor Public School, Mr. Lom. Mum brought him into the kitchen and again ushered me back into the other room. But this time it was different. I knew they were talking about me and I wasn't worried at all. Something about what he was saying, it made sense to me. And he also seemed so sure of what he was saying. And all the questions those people from the Department of Education asked Mum, like how was I going to get around school, he was just saying we'll figure it out. He didn't see me as too hard. He knew that there was a place for me in my local school with my brothers and sisters, the same school that my grandparents went through, and he saw value in having me there.
I love that story, Kurt. But special schools work for some families. And so that might be your story, but it's not everybody's story.
Well, firstly, special schools, they're not special. I feel really uncomfortable with that term because we call them special schools to make ourselves feel comfortable. We need to tell it what it is. We need to use real language. It's a segregated education.
Okay. That's a really loaded word. And I guess I feel a bit uncomfortable about that.
No matter how uncomfortable this makes you feel, I think it's time that we stop hiding behind that word special. I think it's time that we don't feel okay. So I'm going to call it segregated education because that's what it is. And I'm not calling it segregated education to offend you or to disrespect the incredible work that the teachers, principals, and support staff do at these schools every single day, or the very real challenges that led a parent to this choice. It's not that at all.
Okay, so what is this about?
I think it's time that we demand that we do better by our children and young people with a disability. Because no child should be made to feel like they are too hard or that they don't belong. And those very same conversations that we have today, they were had about me 35 years ago. Or you may see that I'm easy, right? I'm the easy case. I wasn't the easy case in 85. It's the same conversation just happening to a different group of people.
It seems really counterintuitive when you've got these schools that are full of specially trained teachers that know how to teach kids with disabilities. They're trained to do it. So it seems on the surface that that kind of investment in that part of the education sector would lead to better outcomes for kids with disabilities.
Not according to the research. The segregated setting actually put kids on a path to lifelong isolation from their community.
All right, let's take a look at why we still have segregated schools for children with disability. Chris Peters chose to send his 11-year-old daughter to Darling Point Special School because mainstream school wasn't working for his family.
We knew that she had some issues and wasn't developing in comparison to other children. She had fine motor skill issues, she had some concentration issues, she had all these issues. But anyway, we thought, well, you know, it might be just a process. We just got to play a bit of catch up. And anyway, she was at that school until we got to the point where she was one step from being removed from the school because she was so disruptive. Not intentionally, but she was very disruptive, very controlling. She's really a one-on-one education type kid.
And so what made you think that this school might be right for your family?
I don't know what first made us come to Darling Point, but we came up to meet with Charmaine and our daughter came there and went into the class and Charmaine had a look at it. And since then, it's been absolutely fantastic. It is so the right place for her. She loves going to the school. She needs one-on-one.
As a parent, we just want our kids to be happy and finding a school they can thrive in is such an important part of this.
I built my career and my identity through what can be seen as a segregated sport, wheelchair racing. And look, I love my Paralympic mom. We are a diverse and inclusive family, but in some ways we grew out of a segregated family. And I know that things are changing. Athletics clubs, swimming clubs, they have para participation in events as well. And so you can see that this issue is so complex and emotional because people with disability find belonging in their segregated spaces.
So one of the main criticisms levelled at segregated schools is that they have a really low expectation of what kids with disabilities can achieve. And this was the case for Luke Nelson.
I rolled out of school and I couldn't read, I couldn't write. I'd like to remind the listeners that I was 18 when I couldn't read or write. So that was not a good experience for me.
Why don't you think you were taught to read or write at your school?
Because I believe that the expectations of people with disabilities in some places weren't that high. And I think community expectations aren't that high. You get out of school and sometimes they go, okay, you'll go to a day service, you'll go somewhere else. So the expectations of having a job, you know, moving out of home or doing something like that, they just weren't there.
Luke's right. Young people that go to a segregated school are excluded from their community from a very early age. And this puts them on a path to day services. Australian Disability Enterprises, the old sheltered workshops, entrenching this isolation and exclusion. And when mainstream school gets it wrong, it can lead to lifelong trauma. David Roy has worked as a teacher for the past 30 years. And when his son was diagnosed with autism, they began early intervention programs through the Department of Education in New South Wales.
We discovered he was getting unexplained bruising. We discovered that he was becoming quite traumatised just having to go to this place. And we removed him, and I apologise. I still find this quite emotional. It came when he likes chocolate. Okay, he had a limited diet in those days of, you know, basically cheese, juice, chocolate. And we had some chocolate in a kitchen cupboard in the corner. And we said, oh, go to the cupboard and get it. He refused to. In fact, he ran away in tears. And we're going, what is going on here? And we had a child in tears, scared of a cupboard in our kitchen. And he just started saying bad teachers. And we found out that children are put into small cupboards. And this was a cupboard. It was an upright cupboard with a like a walk-in door, but it was just shelves all the way up, full of items for the classroom. And you could literally stand in front of the shelves, close the door, and your back is against the door.
What was it like as a parent having that trust abused?
It's guilt. And I am the most guilty because I am the parent who was a teacher saying, no, no, they can't be doing the wrong thing. They're teachers. We don't do that. That was stupid of me.
So what happened with the school and the teacher?
We did end up going, taking legal proceedings. I can't tell you the result of those because we had to sign a confidentiality agreement.
There is no denying that there are valid fears coming from the disability community about attending mainstream schools. When mainstream schools aren't equipped to teach children with a disability, parents feel they have no other option but to enrol their child in a segregated school. But what if we were to demand that the mainstream schools were better, genuinely inclusive, and resourced to support our children with a disability in their community? We are the 15 to 20% of the population. And shouldn't mainstream schools reflect that?
Armstrong Creek School is in Victoria and they are living inclusion. This mainstream school has over 600 kids and 13 to 15% of the students have a disability. Evan Savage is the school's principal.
We're very lucky with the new school. A lot of the environmental things have been done for us, but we think about the instruction, so how we teach, what needs to change, what's different, what is it about the curriculum that's hard to access, the environment, and then the last thing we would focus on is what is it about the student or the learner that might be inhibiting them from being fully included. You know, a school would say, you know what, if only we could do this, we would be able to support that child better. Well, how do we plan for that?
Hannah Prentice moved her family from Melbourne so all three of her kids could enrol at Armstrong Creek School. Its culture of catering to all children is particularly important for her middle child who has Down syndrome and was enrolled in a segregated school.
It was a brilliant school. I can't fault it. They were amazing with her, really, really good. But she developed a lot of behaviours. She got quite aggressive for a little while there. She developed things that she'd never done before, like she started flapping her hands a lot, and it was a lot of challenging behaviour that sort of started when she started at school.
Has there been an effect on your family of having all your kids in one school?
It's been a game changer for us. I think great for them in an inclusive point of view. They don't notice disability. They've got kids in their classes that have a wide variety of different additional needs going on, and half the kids, they don't know that it's a thing.
And this is what inclusion does. Disability becomes part of the fabric of what makes us human and not something to be ashamed of or to hide away or to fear. And that is really powerful for making our whole community inclusive.
But Armstrong Creek isn't every school.
Why not? If Armstrong Creek is on the right track, then why can't we start to create more inclusive schools right across the country? Katya Malakays is a founder of All Means All, the Australian Alliance for Inclusive Education.
When my son Julius was born, I was told about a day later that they suspected that he had Down syndrome. I immediately started to ask the nurses in the maternity ward for recommendations about the best special schools they knew, you know, in my area, etc. My thought process immediately jumped from, I now have a child with a disability, that must mean that this is where he goes. So it's this assumption of special places for special people. I'm not a bad person. I was a pretty ignorant person, and that is like ableism. There are different ways to define it, but it reflects the belief systems that we have about people whose bodies and brains don't conform to a certain idea. Now, I was pretty lucky that I had people around me that started to challenge that, and I'm also sort of quite curious. So then I started reading a lot, and I was shocked. I tell you, I was shocked to discover that the practice of actually separating out people with disability, you know, does not have any support in terms of, you know, education research. So the practice of segregation is not evidence-based. It is a historical practice.
But when a child with a disability turns 5, they need to go to school. And so you have a choice to make. A segregated school or a mainstream school.
Parents are often put in a position where they just have to make Hobson's choice. You know, it's either this, you know, segregated education system, which is not evidence-based and creates a whole bunch of problems, or it's a mainstream system where kids aren't being supported properly, you know, having a really hard time. That is not a choice. But what disabled people and advocates are fighting for is actually for an inclusive education system that we don't have yet.
So what would creating an inclusive education system look like?
So we're talking about transforming the education system to make schools genuinely inclusive of diversity and difference, not just for students with disability, but for other groups as well that have been traditionally, you know, marginalised in education systems as well.
So what do young people think? Margarita has worked as an advocate for children and young people with disabilities and thinks co-design, or asking people with disability what they think the solutions are, is the only place to start.
Where I think co-design can really kick off and really have an impact is in policies, in training programs, in government advisory, in all of those foundation things that build the structures and build schools to then be supportive of students with disability. But I also think that within schools, co-design means that you can have meaningful participation of students in the way that they are in that community.
So what is stopping the education system from being genuinely inclusive? David Roy again.
I will say some of the mainstream schools are fantastic. Yes, there are segregated settings, both within schools and as separate schools. One of the reasons we have those is because the mainstream system is not built to include. So yes, I understand why parents go to these segregated settings and want them, because it's the safest place for their kids to be, even though we also know that segregated settings is where abuse and discrimination is more likely to happen. But it's hard. Everything is a barrier.
While ever there's a release valve out there that is the segregated setting, we will have segregated schools. That gives a chance for a kid with a disability who goes through the mainstream setting to be labelled too hard.
Up next on Let Us In.
She knew no one in the street. She would even try to visit, and she would go to the front door and call out. It was painful. It was so sad.
That's up next on Let Us In. If you like what you've heard, subscribe on the ABC Listen app for all of our episodes, and feel free to share this podcast with everyone you know. This podcast has been produced with the support of the Melbourne Disability Institute and the University of Melbourne. The executive producer is me, Sarah Shands of Point 5 Productions. Fact-checking by Lisa Herbert. Big thanks to Blythe Moore, Phil Ashley Brown, Simon Scoble and Nicole Bond. Sound engineer is Clint Topic from Sawtooth Studios. And all-round ideas guy is the great Grant Walter.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Angela Voipierre, and I'm the host of Schmeichgeist, the new pop culture podcast from ABC Every Day. Every week, we'll decode the biggest trends, some you're a part of and some you're not, to work out why we love what we love. Whether that's astrology, the carnivore diet, hate watching certain reality TV shows, or dressing like a literal child.
I make designer adult pacifiers, and that's not something you hear every day.
And we'll be answering the questions you didn't know you needed answers to, such as why are selfies getting uglier?
I was just like, you know what, balls to the wall, the people need to see.
There's a new episode out every Wednesday on the ABC Listen app.
This is such a great joy for people. You've got to let people have this. Do you know how tough that world is out there?